Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. At this time, we would like to welcome everyone to Braskem's second quarter of 2019 earnings conference call. Today with us, we have Fernando Mussa, CEO, Pedro Freitas, CFO, and Pedro Teixeira, Corporate Finance and Investor Relations Director. We would like to inform you that this event is being recorded, and all participants will be in listen-only mode during the company's presentation. After the Braskem remarks are completed, there will be a question and answer session. At this time, further instructions will be given. Should any participant need assistance during this call, please press star zero to reach an operator. We have simultaneous webcast that may be accessed through the Braskem IR website at www.braskem.com.br/ and the MZiQ platform, where the slide presentation is available for download. Please feel free to flip through the slides during the conference call. There will be a replay facility for this call on the website. We remind you that the questions which will be answered during the Q&A session may be posted in advance on the website. Before proceeding, let me mention that forward-looking statements are being made under the safe harbor of the Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1996. Forward-looking statements are based on the beliefs and assumptions of Braskem management and on information that's currently available for the company. They involve risks, uncertainties, and assumptions because they relate to the future events and therefore depend on the circumstances that may or may not occur in the future. Investors should understand that general economic conditions, industry conditions, and other operating factors could also affect the future results of Braskem and could cause results to differ materially from those expressed in such forward-looking statements. Now, I will turn the conference over to Pedro Teixeira, Corporate Finance and Investor Relations Director. Mr. Teixeira, you may begin your conference.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining Braskem's conference call for the second quarter 2019. Let's jump straight on slide number three, where we talk about our operations in Brazil. First of all, it's important to highlight that the demand in Brazil has fallen by 7% in the second quarter as compared to the first quarter 2019. Braskem sales in the same period had fallen just 4%. It means that on the second quarter, the market share has recuperated from 64% to 67%. Even though the market has fallen by 7%, on a year-to-date, the market has grown in Brazil by 3%. What happened is that in the first quarter, was affected by a movement of rebuilding inventories in the chain, and that's why the market has fallen by 7% on a quarterly basis. However, on a year-to-date basis, the market is up by 3%. It is important to highlight that the utilization rate in this quarter was 89% of the crackers in Brazil. We ran our cracker in Bahia at a lower utilization rate as a result of the shutdown of our operations in Alagoas. However, we ran our cracker in Rio de Janeiro with a higher utilization rate. That's why we kept utilization rates in Brazil on a stable level quarter-over-quarter. On the EBITDA has fallen by 47%, from $293 million on the first quarter to $154 million on the second quarter as a consequence of lower spreads of polymers, as a consequence of the new PE capacity in the U.S. and the lower growth pace of Chinese economy. Moving towards slide number four. Here we highlight our operations in the U.S. and in Europe. In the U.S., we had a very good market. The market has grown by 9%, and our sales has risen by 7%. driven by lower resin prices that encourage converters to rebuild inventories. In Europe, the movement was the opposite. The demand has fallen by 9%, and our sales has decreased by 20%. The demand in Europe was lower because of the slowdown in the economy in the region, and by the summer that usually the demand is weaker during this time, during this quarter. Braskem sales has fallen by 20% as a consequence of lower supply of propylene in one of our facilities in Germany, as a consequence of operational issues in one of our suppliers, and we decided to anticipate a stoppage for maintenance that would happen in the following quarters. We anticipated to the second quarter 2019. All in all, the EBITDA in U.S. and Europe went up by 50%. We will talk a little bit later, but spreads in U.S. are high. We run with our utilization rates much better in the second quarter as compared to the first quarter. So we were able to improve and to increase our EBITDA by 49%. Moving on to slide number 5, here we talk about our operations in Mexico. The PE demand on a quarter over quarter was stable, as well as likewise like our sales, it was stable as well. We ran our facility in Mexico with a capacity utilization rate of 72%. It was 7 percentage points down in comparison with the first quarter 2019, reflecting a lower supply of ethane. As a consequence of that, we have a lower availability of products to export. In the first quarter, we exported 90,000 tons, and the second quarter, we decreased this number to 81,000 tons. The EBITDA of this quarter was 13% lower from 100 that we posted in the first quarter 2019 to $88 million in the second quarter 2019 as a consequence of lower supply of ethane and also lower spread that we faced in the second quarter as compared to the first quarter. Moving to slide number 6, here we talk about our CapEx. We invested in the first half of the year 1.1 million reais. This represented 36% of the 3.3 billion reais that we announced as our investment budget in the beginning of the year. From this 1.1 billion that we already invested, an important portion of that for around 400 million reais is related to our new PP plant that that we are construing in the U.S. that reached 65.5% of physical completion and should become operational in 2020. And we will add 450,000 tons of additional PP in the U.S. Market. Considering the more challenging than expected petrochemical scenario impacted by the slower global economic growth, the company will reduce its 2019 budget for investment by approximately $100 million. We are still analyzing where the cut will happen. However, because of the cycle, because of the petrochemical scenario and the economic growth, we are revisiting what projects should be prioritized. Moving to slide number 7, here we talk about our free cash flow for the first half of the year. On a consolidated basis, we posted in this quarter an EBITDA of 1.6 billion reais, adding up to an EBITDA that we posted in the first quarter of 3.3 billion reais, resulting into an EBITDA of 4.9 billion reais during the first six months of the year. From this 4.9 billion reais, 2.2 billion reais was related to non-recurring events. And the vast majority of such non-recurring events happened in the first quarter of 2019. We discussed these and such events on the previous call. Most of them is related to the recognition of PIS/COFINS tax revenue. So the recurrent EBITDA for the first half of the year, deducting this such non-recurrent event, was 2.7 billion reais. We had a positive impact of working capital variation in this quarter in around 2 billion reais as a consequence of volume of sales that were down, and this reduced the accounts receivable and the increase of volume of imported naphtha at competitive prices and longer payment terms. The maintenance capex, we have already discussed it, 687 million reais. Interest paid accumulated a billion reais since the beginning of the year, and we paid around 200 million reais of income tax. Strategic investments, and the vast majority of that is the Delta project in the PP plant in the U.S., amounted 473 million reais. So adding all of these numbers, we had a positive free cash flow before debt of 2.4 million reais, a strong free cash flow that would represent a 15% return for investors. Moving to slide number 8, here we talk about our debt leverage and credit rating. We ended the quarter with a total cash position of $2.4 billion. If we add the revolving credit facility of $1 billion, we will reach $3.4 billion of liquidity available for the company. Such amount of $3.4 billion is sufficient to cover the debt service of the company, the amortization schedule of the company during 46 months without considering any cash generation of the company. Without considering the 3.8 billion reais that we have in cash blocked as a result of the issue that we have in Alagoas, that we will talk a little bit later in this presentation, the amount of liquidity of the company is sufficient to cover the amortization schedule of the company throughout 38 months. So we have a sufficient amount of liquidity available to serve our debt. Moving to slide number 10, here we bring a slide where we talk a little bit about the situation that we have in Alagoas, the impact, the status. First it's important to discuss and explore what is the business model that we currently have in Alagoas. Before we stopped our operations in Alagoas, we had an integrated model that was integrated from the south until the PVC. So we explored south in Alagoas and plus electricity. We produced a caustic soda and chlorine. Caustic soda we used to sell to clients in the market, and chlorine was used for the production of EDC, VCM, and PVC, and therefore we used to sell PVC to the clients. The company rapidly changed its business model in Alagoas into a non-integrated business model. So as of now, the company is importing caustic soda, so we are no longer producing caustic soda in Alagoas. We do produce caustic soda in Bahia, and the caustic soda that we are importing, we are serving the client. So the clients are being attended from the caustic soda that the company is being imported. We are also importing EDC so that we are able to produce VCM and therefore produce PVC and be able to serve our clients here in Brazil. The non-integrated model, it's of course less competitive than the integrated one, and we bring in the middle of the graph the difference of spread between an integrated and a non-integrated business to give a perspective on the impact. We run our models and a non-integrated business should have an impact around $30 to $40 million per quarter, lower as compared to an integrated model. We are working in some optimization in order to reduce these impacts. On the right side of the slide, we bring some status about the situation that we have in Alagoas. So on the operational front, we are temporarily operating to a non-integrated business model. We are optimizing it to reduce the impact, and we are also evaluating salt mining alternatives. On the technical front, we are passing the sonars. We have already passed 15 out of 35 sonars in our mines. We hire foreign and internet and national experts, and we are conducting additional studies to really understand the situation there in Alagoas. On the legal front, we have 3.8 billion reais of cash blocked. 3.7 billion reais, we are waiting for a decision from the FTJ on the decision to unfreeze, and we are also such amount of cash, and we are also waiting on a decision on our appeal by the Alagoas court. There was 2.5 billion of a new request to freeze our cash by the ministry, by the public ministry of work. The judicial decision is still pending on that front, and the justification hearing is scheduled for August 19. Moving towards slide number 11, here we talk about the outlook for the spreads, and here specifically the spreads that would affect our operations in Brazil. Spreads for chemicals, we expect for 2019 to be 29% lower as compared to 2018. This is mainly as a consequence of new refineries that started up in Asia, generating or making available more co-products in the market and putting the pressure on the prices of chemicals. On the polyolefins, the spread should be 28% lower this year. And this is mainly as a result of the new PE capacity that entered in the market, and also as a result of the slowdown on demand as a result of the trade war. Let's move to slide number 12. And here we bring the forecast for spreads in the U.S., and as you can see, the spreads in the U.S. are stable, slightly higher. We expect the spread to be in 2019 as compared to 2018. The PP market is tight in the U.S. The economy in the U.S. is hot, and there is a higher supply of propylene sustaining the price of propylene in a lower level. We brought in this presentation a new graph showing the level of imports in the U.S. As you can see, in the first half of the year, we had in the market in U.S. 316 1,000 tons of PP. So it's an important sign that the market is capable to absorb the new capacity, the new 450,000 tons capacity that the company will start up in 2020. Moving towards the slide number 13, here we bring the margins in Europe. Unfortunately, the margins should be lower in 2019 as compared to 2018 as a consequence of the slowdown in the Eurozone, especially to a weaker performance of the auto segment. The spread should, of course, be lower as well in Mexico because of the new capacities that are still coming online in the region. We are getting to the final, to the last slide of our presentation, and here we bring a comparison about what we previously estimated for our EBITDA in 2000 in the first quarter of the year, and our, what is our current estimate for 2019. We haven't changed much our view in terms of international spreads. So from May until August, May was the time where we had this conference call last time. The spread hasn't changed much, so we're not expecting any huge impact in terms of spread. Utilization rates, it's also, we are not changing our perspective on that. However, demand should be a little bit lower. The growth of demand, the GDP in Brazil has reduced it from 1.5 to 0.8. We haven't changed our expectation of growth in Europe, the GDP. In the US, in fact, it increased by from 2.3 to 2.6. And in Mexico, the GDP that was estimated to grow by 1.6 was reduced to 0.2%. So we are not expecting any important change in our EBITDA, in our current view as compared to the view that we had in May. So thank you very much. Let's move now to the Q&A session.
Thank you. The floor is now open for questions. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone at this or any time. If at any point your question is answered, you may remove yourself from the queue pressing the pound key. Questions will be taken in the order in they are received. We do ask that when you pose your question that you pick up your handset to provide the optimum sound quality. Our first question, it is from Gustavo Alevato from Santander. Gustavo, you may proceed.
Hi, guys. Good afternoon. So I have a couple of questions. The first one is regarding the cash flow generation. So we noticed that there was a revenue anticipation of 500 million reais. I'd like to understand what's that. And also the supply account, we noticed a significant improvement. Can you explain?
Sorry to interrupt. Can you speak up a little bit?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, please. Go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, the cash flow generation, I would like to understand the 500 million reais regarding revenue anticipation from a client, and also what drove the improvement in the supply account in the second quarter. This is the first question. The second question, when can you expect the update for the 20F, since we are 2 months before the trial in New York? And third and last point, and also regarding the Alagoas issue, you mentioned that there is a trial on August 9. So, but regarding like a potential resume of the operations and potential liabilities, what's the status of the negotiations with the local authorities? Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning for some of you. Gustavo, thanks for your questions. I'll start with the last one, and then I'll ask Pedro Freitas to address the two others. On Alagoas, I would separate. There is a series of legal discussions that will take its necessary course. on the operational side, we have been working on a series of alternatives to move salt, which is the feedstock necessary for the chlor-alkali plants, into the Alagoas, in the Maceió site. So today we are operating under a non-integrated model, importing EDC for the PVC plant, importing caustic soda to serve our clients in Brazil, while we investigate and assess the alternative to bring salt. So the expectation for full return of the chlor-alkali plant are being assessed. It is something that will take several months to be decided slash implemented, given that we basically have two alternatives. One is bring salt from another region, and the challenge for that option is developing the logistics, i.e. receiving and moving the salt into the site, and second, doing some investments to mix the salt with water to create the brine that goes into the industrial process. The second alternative is find another region close by in the Alagoas state where there is no population or close to this area where we could resume the mining operation. This would require licensing for the extraction process and the construction of a brine pipeline to move the brine from the salt extraction site into the industrial plant. This has the licensing timeline plus the building the brine pipeline timeline. Both of those alternatives are being evaluated, and we don't have a definitive timeline yet, but this is something that will take several months to finalize the studies and start the implementation. Pedro, do you want to address the...
Yeah, so on the 20F, we have been working very hard to adjust and analyze the internal controls, as we have been communicating for the past few quarters. We are getting closer to wrapping up the issue. So I think we are working well, and we should be the current expectation. Of course, there are things outside of our control in this process, but we should be ready to file the 20F before the hearing that we have at the NYSC, which is set for October 17th. On the cash advance, or the revenue advance, we have sold the rights that we have in a commercial contract on a non-recourse sale of those rights. We have an obligation to supply the product. It's a regular commercial contract of the company. And we basically sold the revenue rights under that contract upfront. So that's the point that you raised on the cash advancement.
And on the supply side? On the supply side, we've been managing the choices around supply of NAFTA to manage not only profitability but also working capital impact. And typically, these decisions have different outcomes depending on price point and cash flow generation. In the second quarter, we ended up with 35% of the NAFTA being bought from Petrobras, which has a shorter, we pay at site, so there is no working capital financing, and 65% from imports, which going back several years, we would see the exactly opposite, two-thirds being acquired locally from Petrobras and one-third being acquired from imported suppliers, from foreign suppliers. So this set of decisions...
Just on the supply side also, we also see an increase because the compound impact of the price of naphtha in the international market, which increased by roughly 10%, and also currency fluctuations. So we also see those effects.
Yeah.
But the main one is, as Fernando said, the increase in naphtha imports, which have a longer term payment terms, we are able to secure those from our suppliers.
Okay, clear. If I may do a follow-up, I just to understand, how much more does the company pay for the imported naphtha compared to Petrobras naphtha? I know that's a decision not looking for just profitability, but also looking the working capital. If you could give us some color just to have an idea for our forecast.
The imported naphtha is not necessarily more expensive. We have multiple suppliers. The quality of the naphtha is a relevant factor. Some cargoes might have a quality that benefits the production of propylene. Others will have a lower yield on propylene, as an example. So the choice of whom we buy from and the value of it, it also is impacted by the quality of the naphtha, the intrinsic specs of the naphtha. So your statement that imported naphtha is more expensive than local naphtha is not necessarily true every single time. It will depend on where we're buying from. We have some shorter contracts, not as long as the Petrobras contract, but 1-2 year agreements where it has one logic. Sometimes we buy on the spot, so you have opportunities when the market is very long. So it's a very diversified portfolio. And as I said, we look at both the cost and the flow to assess the decision. From a financial point of view, but a big component of the choice is the quality, the source, the cargoes to help us optimize logistics and optimize the production at the crackers here in Brazil.
Okay, very clear.
Our next question is from Luis Carvalho. Luis, pode prosseguir.
Thank you, guys. Hi, Musa. Hi, Pedro. I have basically two questions here. Last year we discussed about the recurring EBITDA level for the company, and now we're seeing, as you just mentioned in the presentation, lower demand in China, Mexico, and Europe, higher capacity still coming from U.S., potentially maybe lower import tariffs and the rake and in Brazil. FX rate is below 4, and also we're seeing lower domestic margins, which we're going to discuss a bit in the second question. So we're pointing, every single point that we look to the environment today points to a new level of EBITDA for at least 2019 and 20, right? We were discussing between $3 and $3.5 billion last year, and now potentially we are pointing to something on a recurring basis close to, $1.8 to $1.9 billion, right? So I saw that you announced the year to the CapEx cut, but I would like to know what are the other measures that the company might take to address or to face this challenging environment that we see ahead. The second question is a bit more on the domestic front. We saw, and also in Mexico, we saw the EBITDA margin dropping from 18% to 6% year over year, while at the same time you kept the market share stable and also you increased the exports by 10%. In Mexico, EBITDA margin dropped from 57% to 32%, potentially on a lower utilization, So I just would like to understand what is basically driving this lower EBITDA margin, if it's just a lower spread, so higher competition, or you basically have to lower the prices to keep the market share in Brazil. So just try to, I don't know, get a bit more color on the strategy of the company to face this higher competition as well. Thank you.
Thank you. So on the first question, clearly we're facing a more challenging external environment from a petrochemical spreads point of view, but also a lot of uncertainty from an economic growth point of view, especially driven by the China-U.S. dispute that is having repercussions in multiple other regions as well. So, as you mentioned, we are, of course, analyzing this and reflecting this into our planning. One first impact is the revision of the portfolio of projects and the assessment of projects that had been thought of in a scenario where we would see recovery of the spread cycle sooner compared to what we see today. They probably don't make that much sense. So we've been flipping from capacity growth / improving reliability of supply projects to more cost savings and productivity type projects. So part of the reduction is this conceptual change, which puts some projects on hold, and it takes a while for us to reprioritize and start working on the other projects that have a different type of impact. So the first answer is not only we're cutting down the CapEx expected for this year, and probably for next year we will adjust the level towards our expectations for next year, but the intrinsic portfolio, the portfolio should have a different type of impact with more projects focused on cost savings, be it fixed costs, variable costs at the plants, etc. On top of that, we have been looking at a series of other initiatives towards process improvements, efficiency and effectiveness in the business processes that we have been looking at it for quite a while in the quest of improved performance. The current scenario is accelerating a series of those processes and decisions. We should see this impact coming to hit the bottom line in the next few months. Several examples that I could mention for including investments in new digital tools that are leading to improved operation at the plants through modeling and use of these models into how we do quality control, reducing the number of people in the labs and the number of samples that we need to take out from the process. Use of robotic process automation in the shared services areas that has led to the reduction of the number of people necessary for transactional operations are two examples that we've been working on and are accelerating to have those impacts. On top of that, we have a new project coming online on 2020, which should help us, the new PP plant in the U.S. So we'll have additional capacity. So it's going to provide us with improved profitability once it starts. And one of the key challenges from an operational point of view that we have been facing is the availability of ethane in Mexico. And we've been looking at ways to improve that supply, both working with Pemex to improving its ability to serve us, but also working on alternatives for us to import directly, which would help us, but also if we make a new infrastructure for imports viable, it will help Pemex as well in its management of its production and supply of ethane in the country. So a series of activities trying to or incorporate this cycle perspective into the decision making of the company in capital programs, in process improvements, structure, number of people, etc. As far as the margins are concerned, I would say that it is mainly the spread, the global spreads. We do have a series of small, relative to Braskem size, smaller internal operational issues. And the supply issue in Germany is one example. The Alagoas plant being shut down is another example. But, I mean, every year we have a series of internal or external factors. Like last year, we had the truck driver strike in Brazil that created some challenges. We had in the summer the low Rhine creating challenges for production in Germany. So key driver of the change in margins, I would say, is the global spread scenario for our industry.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question is from Petri from Barclays. Petri, you may proceed.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Peter Grishenko with Barclays. I have some questions on the asset freeze and the judicial deposits. Can you maybe provide an update on the last piece you mentioned early in the call about $2.5 billion? Potential freeze, and how do you expect liquidity to be impacted if this goes through? Also, just wanted to confirm the $2.5 billion U.S. liquidity that you mentioned, that still includes $1 billion of frozen assets. And I mean, any color on that end would be helpful.
Okay, so on the asset freeze, just to recap where we are. Today we have 3.8 billion reais of our accounts frozen by the courts here in Brazil. The 2.5 is another lawsuit or process in the courts that was started more recently on the same facts by a different part of the judicial system in Brazil. This one follows a separate and different process. We do not expect this to happen. It is a representation of the current status, which is an ask by the prosecutor of this freeze. But the underlying fact is the same one that led to the current freeze, which we are disputing in court. And we will do the same with that one. We do not see this happening. We'll see how this plays out. Our legal actions have been always to discuss in the courts the underlying facts to start with, and then provide the necessary guarantees to the courts that if in the future there is any culpability against Braskem proven in courts, that we have the ability to face it from a financial point of view. There is no need for those additional account freeze, especially given that we have provided a surety bond to the courts that could provide that insurance, quote-unquote, to the legal system. So, yes, it is out there, the lawsuit. We do not expect it to be granted, this additional freeze, given that it's the same underlying factor. and there would be no need for guaranteeing it twice. On the liquidity issue, I would let Pedro to address.
Yeah, so on the liquidity, we today, with the cash freeze, we are still able to operate normally. We've made some adjustments in our cash management so that the cash is at the right places in our system. But we are able to keep operating normally, and the cash freeze does not create any limitation on our ability to fulfill our obligations. We also have a revolving credit facility of $1 billion, which is undrawn, and which we can use at any time. It's a revolving credit facility that is standing until 2023, the one that we have right now. It was contracted with a pool of banks last year. I think it's important to say as well that even considering the cash blockage that we have right now, we have 38 months of debt coverage in our cash. So again, we have the average term of our cash is close to 9 years, and we have obviously a very conservative liquidity policy, and that shows even with close to $1 billion blocked, we still have 38 months of that coverage.
Okay. Also, maybe following up on the Algoa issue that's been already discussed, has there been an update in terms of the timing for the studies, and when do you think you expect reviews to conclude?
We are focusing the studies towards providing more information address the issue of what needs to be done so that the people who had to be removed from their homes can go back home safely. There are two types of studies. Some of them try to understand what's happening with the soil and therefore with the structures on the surface. The other type of studies is interpreting this and looking for the solutions to understand the risk and to address the risk for that. So this is something that happens in phases, and as we get new information, we process those and adjust the course of action. So we do expect that by over the next few months until the end of the year, we'll have way more clarity on both topics so that we can discuss with the relevant authorities our point of view, so that the actions that might be necessary for the population to be comfortable with what's happening, understand what's happening, and for them to be able to go back to their homes are addressed correctly. So there's no definitive timeline, because some of those studies will lead to potentially, for example, engineering studies on how to implement a certain engineering solution for a part of a neighborhood. Since we still don't have clarity on all those potential quote-unquote solutions, it's hard to give a total timeline for when this will be designed and implemented. We're working on, my expectation is that by the end of the year, we'll have way more clarity than we have today, which will be good for the population, but also for us, given the impact that this clarity would have for the operations of Rapscan, but also for the whole legal process that is going on in parallel.
Got it. That's very helpful. And maybe switching gears, can you perhaps provide an update on the status of the controlling stake. Do you have any idea on the timing when the final ruling can come out, whether Odebrecht is allowed to keep shares, and whether you think this could impact your deliberations on dividends?
So I'll give you my current understanding of the situation of Odebrecht. We do not have direct access to it, and we do not participate in this process. So our current understanding is that Odebrecht filed for recuperação judicial, which is something similar to a Chapter 11. It's not exactly the same, but similar to Chapter 11 in the U.S. Under that process, they have 60 days to present a plan to their debt holders on what they plan to do and for the restructuring of the company. The Braskem shares have been given in guarantee to debt that is not included in this Chapter 11 procedure. And formally, the filing done by Odebrecht asked the court to consider it as a relevant instrument for the restructuring of the overall holding company. The judge granted something towards that line in the standstill, 180-day standstill on the bank's ability that have the debt to exercise their guarantee. The banks went to court and disputed that. So my understanding today is that if the banks that have that guarantee would exercise their guarantee, they could do it. They have not done it. So I assume that when the banks and Odebrecht have been discussing this process and are trying to find a solution that will address the needs and constraints of the two processes. In a concrete term, today Odebrecht owns the shares. They are not part of the Chapter 11 formal restructuring. The banks that have that debt have not exercised any guarantee, and therefore the political rights, the economic rights have not changed compared to previous discussion. The dividend discussion has another logic and has nothing to do with that. Given the situation that we faced that created unexpected and situation that was not seen before in the country under our judicial system. Here, we were not able to discuss in the General Assembly the dividends, and now the board and management, we have been discussing, given the petrochemical scenario and the legal situation around the Alagoas geological issue. We've been discussing what to do with the dividends, and we should have a decision in the future, the near future, on what to do with dividends. This has no link to what's happening with Odebrecht.
Just to complement, if we look at our commercial, if I might say, so, relationship to Odebrecht, we don't have any meaningful receivables from them, so there is no exposure there. And also, we don't have any cross-default or cross-acceleration clauses that would trigger an acceleration of Braskem debt because of the Odebrecht. In a potential change of control, we would only have provisions for that acceleration if there were a downgrade of Braskem debt, of Braskem rating,
because of
the change of control. But in the current situation, there is no cross acceleration provision.
Sorry, I didn't catch the last thing you said. Can you repeat it, please? You said the only impact you expect is what on the debt?
No, there's no impact.
No, there is no impact. What I said is that we don't have any meaningful credit exposure to Odebrecht on the commercial side. And on the debt side, we don't have cross-acceleration or cross-default provisions that would trigger any of Braskem's debt because of the situation at Odebrecht. So our credit exposure is completely segregated. And the only thing that would lead to a potential credit debt acceleration would be a change of control that leads to rating downgrade at Braskem. Which is not the scenario right now. So.
Yes, of course. Okay, got it. And maybe last question. Can you perhaps comment on the Braskem Idesa, any progress on, any planning on building, ethane importing terminal? There were some reports recently kind of discussing this. Any latest thoughts on that would be very helpful. And also, can you perhaps mention what was the highest utilization rates at a plant during the second quarter? And if you expect, basically the measures appropriate to pay dividends at some point?
So on the imports, we are working on a couple of alternatives to support the construction of the necessary infrastructure to substantially improve the ability of the Mexico region where we are located and where the Mexico, the Pemex crackers are also located, to increase the this region's ability to import. The main bottleneck is the would be the construction of a terminal with cryogenic tanks and the associated unloading and pipelines to move the ethane to our plants and Pemex plants. This is a large project which we've been discussing with multiple interested parties on building and operating the terminal. We have more than one option for that solution. So we're working very hard ourselves together with Pemex, because this infrastructure would be helpful with Pemex as well, and potential investors to make this a concrete project, not only a discussion. So we're working on that. In parallel, we've been looking at alternatives that could be more short-term, maybe less efficient, less sizable, but that we could implement sooner, given that building a terminal and the cryogenic tank could take a couple of years. So we've been looking at other alternatives that we're close to make viable. If and when those become a reality, we will, of course, communicate to the market. But we are working around that. On the availability, and I mean, what's the peak utilization rate? One of the challenges we have been facing, we face two challenges. First, the average utilization rate in the quarter was low. It was 72%, if my memory is correct. But the second challenge is it has been very volatile. So some days we're close to 100 days, around 100%. Some days we go to 30% availability of ethane. So it's been very volatile. We do have some storage of ethane and some storage of ethylene that balances this volatility in the intake of ethane. But we have not seen, on average, anything lower than 70. It was close to the lowest we've seen, and it is close to the lowest we expect going forward. So our view is it's 170 up that we should be expecting. And the second quarter was one where when we were close to the lower bounds of the ability of the parasitic system to serve us with ethane. With those long-term and short-term solutions for import being implemented, the ability to supply the complex either from banks or from by ourselves will increase, and we should see increased operating rates with imported ethane in the future.
Got it. That's very helpful. Thank you, guys, and best of luck.
Our next question is from Bruno Montanari for Morgan Stanley. Bruno, you may proceed.
Thanks for taking the questions. Two quick follow-ups. One on the Pemex ethane import infrastructure. Are the discussions you alluded to in this conference call in line with what Pemex included in their business plan? Because if memory serves me right, they're saying they'll double the import capacity between 2019 and 2020. Or would these discussions mean extra import capacity than what they have on the business plan that they just recently published? Second question, just to check on the NAFTA imports in Brazil, is this 65% import rate sustainable, or should we think of it as more of a one-off opportunity you took advantage of in the quarter? Thank you.
So on the import capabilities in Mexico, we know that Pemex has its own system. They are already importing, and they have been looking at ways to improve their own ability to import through their current system. I would say I don't have the details of their plan and what's included. And I saw the same data, but I don't know if they're counting on the potential terminal that would that is being discussed as part of that or not. Regardless of that, the long-term solution that we've been discussing would certainly create way more import capabilities than doubling the current Pemex capability. So I would say it is extra. I don't know if everything that we've been discussing is extra, or if Pemex included part of their improvement is using this new infrastructure. I would not know the answer to that question, but I would say it's fair to say that we should have more import capabilities in the region than doubling the current Pemex ability to import. On the NAFTA import, the 65% it is sustainable. But as discussed before, it is the consequence of a series of choices that have many operational and economic drivers. It will be 65% imported as long as those drivers lead to that decision. We have proved over the last several quarters that our ability to import needs to improve and has been improving. The key bottleneck is logistics. We have been working on our logistics system to improve that ability, and we have been working with other owners of parts of the logistics infrastructure necessary to import, including Petrobras, to improve our ability to import directly, not depending on buying from Petrobras. So many of those small investments and or adaptations on how we operate the terminal's tanks have been implemented in the last few months. So we can operate importing 65%, maybe even a little bit higher from a logistics point of view, from a sustainable point of view. If it will be 65 or not, I mean, the economic and financial variables and the quality, which is also a big driver of the choice of NAFTA and where it comes from, given the different co-products will be produced depending on the type of NAFTA, different amounts. All of them are produced, but the amounts change and can change significantly from one type of cargo to the other. Those factors will influence that. So our key strategic move, I would say, in the naphtha supply has been to create the ability to have a more diversified supply base through the development of contracts and or commercial relationships to buy the molecule, and improving the logistics setup so that we can move it into our complexes. Those two aspects have received a lot of attention over the last couple of years, and we're seeing the impact of it in this quarter as a clear illustration of our ability to bring more naphtha from other sources around the world.
Great, thank you very much.
Our next question is from Hassan Ahmed from Alembic Global. Hassan, you may proceed.
Hi there, Fernando and Pedro. Hope you guys are well. Look, as you know, as I take a look at the back half of 2019, it just seems that the drum roll seems to get more and more negative with, you know, supply additions imminent, macro concerns, you know, trade war related uncertainties and the like. But then I start taking a look at spot U.S. markets, and they're very different from the same time last year, meaning spot ethane prices are collapsing, spot ethylene prices seem to be popping. So what is it, you know, that the spot market's seeing that I guess corporate management isn't? I mean, it doesn't seem, through the lens of the spot markets, things don't seem that dire. They actually seem quite good. So what's going on in your view?
Hello, Hassan. Nice talking to you. I think it's a fair question. My reaction would be that you're comparing two very different dynamics. One is a short term, which is the spot, which has a lot of, and you're focused on two products, ethane and ethylene, that honestly, by themselves, are completely useless, right? So it's all about what does the ethylene become, and then how is this traded? So I always tend to look at the integrated chain, and PE being the biggest user of ethylene is a key driver of all this dynamic. So I would say this volatility in ethane and ethylene creates noise in the U.S. It's driven by availability of ethane that is a direct consequence of oil and associated gas, and the need to extract to respect the specs on the natural gas that goes into the pipelines and the LNG. The ethylene is all about a very thin spot market relative to the total production and consumption of ethylene in the U.S. And I mean, if you look at the PE export prices out of the U.S., so and they've been under $900 per ton for a while. It's been a while since we've seen such a low price, and when the low price is driven by the global PE supply and demand expectations of the economic cycle, the spread cycle. So I agree with you that in short term, you have weird phenomena. If you go to the C3PP chain, you also have some of those weird phenomena between propylene and PP in the U.S. and propane, propylene pricing, and very weird movements happening. If you look at day by day, week by week, in propylene, but the PPE price and PPE logic globally has been pretty stable. So my view is midterm, it is a very challenging market because of the macroeconomic environment, the uncertainty that trade wars are creating for many value chains, the challenge that all this is creating for growth in China, the repercussion of that to other regions. Plus, we did have a big wave of new projects being built in the U.S. and also in China that are hitting the markets when, I mean, growth of demand is kind of slowing down a little bit compared to, not negative growth. It's just, I mean, it's growing less strong, not as strong as anticipated before. So,
Understood. It's just one of those quirky markets.
I hope you're right on your last report on an up cycle coming sooner rather than later. I've not seen it.
It's always darkest before dawn.
Yeah.
Now, as a follow-up, slightly longer-term question, you know, every second day these days, you know, there's yet another new headline encouraging recycling, talking about cities, states, counties, countries, you know, imposing plastic bans in some way or form. Again, you know, tough to sort of analyze exactly what that'll do to sort of eventual demand growth. But, you know, if one were to take a realistic view, or actually more than a realistic view, you know, err to the side of caution, it seems if, you know, some of these single-use plastic bans are implemented, more and more guys sort of, you know, start recycling. I mean, at most, it may shave maybe 70 basis points off of global demand growth for, you know, something like polyethylene. So my first question around that is, what are your views around that? I mean, do you think that, you know, seriously impedes demand growth going forward? Is a drop in the bucket? I mean, you know, so that's one part. And the second part is more brisk and specific. Are you guys seeing more and more interest in, you know, the legacy product that was green polyethylene?
Okay, this is a very relevant point. I would frame the issue slightly different than you did. I would say the recycling is creating a new source of plastics that will be added to the plastic that comes from our current plants. So I think the industry has a challenge that we need to address the recycling or the end of life issue, especially for single use. To solve that, the solution seems to be recycling, and this will lead to another source of plastic coming from the feedstock that is used plastic. So demand, given the contributions that plastic has to product performance, food safety, cost, flexibility to use, this plastic will continue to be used. And if we solve the recycling issue, demand should not suffer, might accelerate.
Yeah.
Total demand. But you have a new plant, quote unquote, coming from a different type of feedstock. It's not gas, it's not naphtha, it's not propane. It's recycled plastic that will lead to a different type of plastics that most likely, for quite a while, will need to be blended somehow with the virgin that comes from naphtha or from gas to have the quality performances that are necessary to achieve product quality for consumers. So this is something that is creating a challenge and an impact because things are moving very fast, as you said. It's very easy to ban, but when it's not that obvious to substitute with the same quality, with the same cost, with the same environmental impact. Some of the alternatives that are used once it's banned end up having a worse environmental impact. So it's something that we will see as a bigger driver, but it becomes also a big opportunity for us. It becomes an opportunity in two fronts. One is using this recycle and fostering and becoming one of the users of this new feedstock and changing, therefore, our product portfolio with this recycled resin. And it also, going back to your second question, gives a little lift to our green polyethylene because, and I say a little lift because the renewable base doesn't address this challenge of end of use, end of life use. It is another aspect that it addresses its carbon footprint. Mm. So if you combine recycled with virgin and the virgin being green, then you have a pretty interesting combination. So we have an advantage towards that. And we've been working around that. And this could be a differentiator compared to others. That, I mean, we're ahead of the game in our ability to combine recycling with regular virgin, with the green virgin, quote-unquote, plastics to create solutions that address different problems for different clients. So I wouldn't say that this is leading to increased demand for green tea today. But we have good expectations that the combination of those three type of plastics will be very compelling, and therefore we should see an increased lift coming from this.
Very helpful, Fernando. Thank you so much.
Our next question is from Fernanda Cunha from Citi. Fernanda, you may proceed. Fernanda Cunha, you are on the line. Make your question.
Hi. Good afternoon, everyone. I just have a quick follow-up on Mexico utilization rate. When we look at Pemex ethane output for this quarter, for the second quarter, it has dropped very little against the first quarter. So I'd just like to understand, are there other off-takers right now in Mexico that is leading to less ethane available for your plant, or was there any one-off impact in this quarter that drove down your utilization rate? If you can give any color on that, I appreciate it.
Yes.
Thanks.
So there are two consumers of ethane in Mexico, our plant and the crackers that are owned and operated by Pemex. So if you look at Pemex ethane production, it will be used to supply our Braskem Idesa and also to supply its own polyethylene, ethylene oxide plants, for example. So that's why it's important to create an infrastructure to import, to increase resilience of the system so that not only they can serve our contract and respect the limits of the contract, but also to give them the ability to run their plants at a higher utilization rate. Given the structure of the contract, if you look at how they've been operating the system, they have privileged serving us versus serving their own plants if necessary. This is not a long-term sustainable solution. That's why we've been discussing with them that jointly making an effort to create a sustainable and larger infrastructure that is competitive to import ethane is going to be good for both of us so that they can serve us better, they can serve their own plants better, and while they work on improving their production of natural gas and the extraction of ethane so that they reduce the need to import. But this is going to take a while.
Okay, thanks. That's very helpful.
Our next and last question is from Jenny Michelson from Credit Suisse. Jenny, you may proceed.
Hi, thanks so much for the call. I just have a quick question about your the comments that you were making about your working capital and generating cash by upfront sales of your commercial contract. I'm wondering if you could give a little bit of background. Was this a move to generate cash given the constraints on your cash, and do you expect to continue to be able to generate cash flow off of your working capital for the rest of the year? What's your outlook for being able to do further transactions along this line? And then also, just to clarify, your cash without the judicial deposits is down to $1.4 billion. Is that correct? Thank you.
So, Jane, thank you for your questions. This is Pedro Freitas. On the second one, it is correct. I mean, the $1.4 billion is our cash already, excluding the judicial or the asset freeze. Considering the about the advanced sales, I mean, we do commercial agreements with clients regularly, where different forms of payment and different forms of different agreements around how clients are going to pay us are negotiated. In this particular case, we've done it this way. I mean, we do this, not necessarily the same structure as this one, but we do this type of agreement with clients, looking at costs and the commercial interests of the company all the time. So it is a regular tool that the company has available for use at any time that we need.
And do you expect, regarding working capital, do you expect that to be a further source of cash for the remainder of the year or flat? Can you give us some guidance on what you expect in terms of cash generation for the second half of the year? Thanks.
So looking at working capital, as Fernando said earlier, we have moved towards more imported naphtha, which has longer payment terms. We may have some more in the renewals of contracts or new sources that we are developing. We may have some additional opportunities to generate cash from extending payment terms with suppliers. So it is a possibility, but it will depend always, as always. I mean, even in the terms we have today, we look at the cost of doing that and the convenience, the commercial convenience of doing that. So it is, I would say, an analysis that is done and is considered as a whole in the looking at the overall interest of the company.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for the call.
With that concludes our Q&A section. I will turn over to the company for closing remarks.
I would like to thank all of you for participating in this second quarter discussion. As we discussed, the industry is facing a series of challenges, but Braskem is also facing its own set of peculiar and private specific challenges. But as in previous situations, we see the strength of the Braskem team, the dedication, the commitment, looking for solutions and working very hard to address the issues and, I mean, think about the current but also the long-term perspective of our clients, of our suppliers, the regions where we operate, the communities we operate in, to look for interesting projects and ideas. So we will continue pursuing our strategy of improving productivity and competitiveness, diversification of feedstock, diversification from a geographic point of view, As we progress and have more clarity on what's happening in the cycle, but also with the shareholder structure, we have now the ability to pursue some ideas, opportunities that were kind of on hold during the whole LyondellBasell discussion. Since that stopped in early June, many of those conversations that were put on hold towards interesting projects have restarted. Some of them make even more sense in the current cycle environment. Some of them make less sense, but I mean, we're pursuing some very interesting opportunities that could generate interesting value creation, and we'll continue to pursue those in the quest for the right balance between the financial health of the company, but value creation short and long term. So thank you very much for your attention today, and looking forward to another discussion in 3 months' time with the first quarter results. Bye.
Thank you. This concludes today's Braskem Earnings Conference Call. You may disconnect your lines at this time.